Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
I'm Robin Ince.
Welcome to the 27th season of The Infinite Monkey Cage.
And we are dealing with some very, very explosive things, such as
bees.
We're going to explain how bees explode, why wasps don't explode, how delicious wasp honey is, before we then climb into a supervolcano, metaphorically.
And then we're going to discover how you might feed yourself inside the supervolcano by eating fungi.
Or ultra-processed food. We're also going to look at ancient DNA and
sharks.
Listen to The Infinite Monkey Cage wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Qureshi, and at 1300 hours GMT on the 29th of June, these are our main stories. France sends in 40,000 police to quell riots after an officer shot a teenager dead.
The situation is still very tense and people are still very angry. All of this has been going on for too many years.
Appeal court judges rule UK government plans to send asylum seekers to Rwanda are unlawful. Ukraine says a suspect in a deadly restaurant attack was recruited by Russia before the invasion. Also in this podcast, find out why Sri Lankans are getting an extended holiday weekend. And yes, there is such a thing as a good virus. We'll tell you more about that. Following two nights of violent protest against the fatal shooting of a teenage motorist in a Parisian suburb, the French government has announced it will deploy 40,000 police officers this evening, 5,000 of them on the streets of Paris. Demonstrators have attacked cars, police stations, schools and town halls and thrown fireworks, petrol bombs and projectiles at the police in Paris and in several other cities. The officer who shot the 17-year-old, known as Nahel, who was of North African heritage, has been placed under a homicide investigation. After an emergency cabinet meeting this morning, President Emmanuel Macron said he could understand that emotions were running high, but said there was no justification for violence.
Clearly, the emotion that comes with the death of a young man calls for contemplation and calm, and it's what the government has constantly called for. I think this is what should continue to guide the next hours and the tributes. It has been the subject of reactions, presumably attempts to change what happened, and the last hours have been marked by violent scenes against police stations, but also schools and town halls, and basically against institutions and the Republic.
I asked the newsroom's Junat Jalil, who's in Paris, whether the deployment of extra police officers would calm the situation.
That's really hard to say, Nick. Yesterday we saw the President and the Interior Minister talking of their shock at that video of the shooting. And President Macron said the police action was inexcusable, which angered the police unions in the far right, who said he was rushing to judgment. And 2,000 police were deployed last night to the Paris suburbs. But all this wasn't enough to stop the clashes escalating and spreading across the country to other cities. So today, what we've seen has been much tougher language from the government, with Mr. Macron saying such violence is unjustified. He's clearly worried that France could see a repeat of 2005 with riots erupted in the deprived, mainly immigrant suburbs of French cities over the deaths of two young men who were being chased by the police. And those riots went on for weeks.
Well, that's what President Macron has had to say. What are the community in Nanterre saying?
Well, people there are angry about the shooting which occurred in their community, but at the same time, they're also scared by the violence of the past two nights, which has seen their local businesses vandalised, cars burnt, all kinds of damage, which has disrupted their lives.
How much, Junat, has this got to do with race?
Quite a lot, because community leaders have been explaining that this explosion of rage has occurred because young people in the suburbs feel that even if they're second, third, maybe fourth generation immigrants, completely French culturally, They feel like they're second-class citizens, that France will never fully accept them. They feel that they're victimized by the police, and they say that the only reason the authorities reacted the way they did to the shooting on Tuesday was because of that video filmed by a bystander, which flatly contradicted the account that was being given by the police. So even if charges are brought against this officer, many people will say that's not enough. And one particular area of concern is a law that was introduced back in 2017, which gave police broader powers to use their firearms, including at traffic stops. And rights groups say this is open to abuse. Last year, we saw a record number of fatal police shootings of people who were in vehicles that didn't comply with a traffic stop. There were 13 such killings, and those who died were mostly either black or of Arab origin.
Jannat Jalil. Here in the UK, the Court of Appeal has ruled that the British government's plan to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda is unlawful. The court said Rwanda could not be treated as a safe third country and that people being sent there could be sent back to their home countries and face persecution. Here's the Lord Chief Justice, Lord Burnett, reading out the majority decision of the three judges.
The result is that the High Court's decision that Rwanda was a safe third country is reversed, and that unless and until the deficiencies in its asylum processes are corrected, removal of asylum seekers to Rwanda will be unlawful. Finally, I should make clear that our decision implies no view whatever about the political merits or otherwise of the Rwanda policy. Those are entirely a matter for the government, on which the court has nothing to say. Our concern is only whether the policy complies with the law as laid down by Parliament.
He, however, agreed with the High Court's decision that Rwanda is a safe third country. Our political correspondent Rob Watson told us what it meant for the government.
And the long and the short of it is, it means that Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, now has a massive headache on his plans because, as you say, although the judges were split, it means that the government cannot deport asylum seekers from the UK to Rwanda unless and until that decision is reversed, possibly after an appeal to the UK's highest court, the next court up, if you like, and that is the Supreme Court. That would seem to be the only option that the government has if indeed it wants to persist with this policy. It's been pointed out that maybe to some extent he could turn this to his advantage somehow and say, oh, you know, this shows you the problems with sort of lefty lawyers and European human rights legislation getting in the way. But that's a risky path to go down, because if Mr. Sunak and the government do want to do that, I mean, do they really want to leave the European Convention on Human Rights? I mean, only two other countries have done that, and that's Belarus and Russia. Does the UK really want to be in that kind of company? I mean, on the other hand, Mr. Sunak knows that the idea of deporting asylum seekers from the UK to Rwanda is certainly very, very popular with some elements of Conservative Party voters.
Rob Watson. Well, the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, confirmed the government would appeal that decision at the Supreme Court. Let's get the reaction from the Rwandan side with our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher, who's in Nairobi.
The spokesperson for the government said really this was ultimately a decision up to the UK judiciary, but they did take issue with the ruling that Rwanda was not a safe country for asylum seekers and refugees. They said it's one of the safest countries in the world. It had been recognized by the UN for exemplary treatment of refugees, even. The UN has actually welcomed the ruling. It has opposed this deal, largely because it said that Britain shouldn't abdicate its responsibility on this issue to other nations. But it did raise some concerns about Rwandan refugee system. It said specific incidents of refugees had been forced to return to their home country where they could be persecuted. So it has taken that position on Rwanda's system when it comes to the UK deal. But Rwanda isn't giving up. The government spokesman said they were still committed to making the partnership work. The opposition, on the other hand, the Green Party, which had opposed the deal, welcomed the ruling, said it vindicated their position, said that the deal was really illegal if you looked at international regulations on how to handle asylum seekers.
Barbara Plett-Usher. The mother of a 16-year-old girl allegedly beaten to death by security forces during protests in Iran has spoken of her continuing heartache. Speaking to actress Zar Amir Ebrahimi, who fled Iran in 2008, Nasreen Shakarami says she cannot forget for a second what happened to her daughter Nika. The Iranian authorities deny any wrongdoing in Nika's death. Yalda Hakim reports.
In September 2022... the death of a young woman, Mahsa Amini, in police custody triggered anti-government protests across Iran. A family member wept at her graveside.
I swear to God that when she left home, her clothes were so appropriate. She was dressed more appropriately than all of your daughters.
The Iranian authorities pledged to investigate Mahsa's death. They insisted that the protests were organized by foreign powers.
Woman, life, freedom.
A BBC documentary team has analyzed over 100 hours of footage from those protests and verified 350 videos.
I was involved in several films this year, and I was traveling and promoting the movies, and in the middle of all this, the killing of Mahsa happened.
Zahr Amir Ibrahimi was once a famous TV actor in Iran. She's now an international movie star.
I was transformed from an actress interested in women's rights into an activist, and I accidentally got politically involved in the movement.
And she's been gathering testimony on how the authorities responded in the early days of the uprising. She speaks to them over a video call.
How are you, Miss Amir Ibrahim?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm very glad to meet you.
Nasreen had a teenage daughter called Nika.
She was extremely adventurous and fearless. I was always afraid that something would happen to her.
4 days after Mahsa Amini died, Nika was filmed setting fire to her headscarf.
I told her that it is dangerous and please come home. She finally said she would. I could hear other protesters shouting the security forces.
They never heard from her again. Her death certificate stated she died from multiple injuries caused by the impact of a hard object. The regime denied wrongdoing and made inconsistent claims about her death.
I personally have a lot of respect for Nika's bravery and free spirit. I believe that we are living in a specific point in history where such events are needed.
In Iran today, the mass street protests have died down for now. But acts of defiance continue on social media. A popular Afrobeat song is being used as a song of solidarity. They filmed themselves dancing alone, in groups, and even on public transport. Dancing like this can get you arrested. But they're still dancing.
Yalda Hakim with that report. And people in the UK can watch Inside the Iranian Uprising on BBC iPlayer. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says an alleged Russian agent involved in the attack on the city of Kramatorsk will be charged with treason. 12 people, including 3 teenagers, were killed in Tuesday's missile strike on a popular restaurant. Mr. Zelensky said those helping Russia destroy lives deserve the maximum penalty. Our correspondent Gordon Carrera, who's in Kyiv, told me what we know about the suspects.
Ukrainian security service say they arrested an individual who they describe as a spotter for this attack, and they say he's a local, an employee of a local gas transportation company. Okay. It's interesting, they claim he was actually recruited by Russian military intelligence, the GRU, before the invasion last year as a kind of sleeper agent, and was then activated and asked to carry out reconnaissance and provide information on targets. They claim that he actually filmed this specific pizzeria restaurant and the car park around it and provided that information to Russia, which then facilitated the strike, which, as you said, killed 12 people on Tuesday.
So many people said to be involved in this.
Yes, that's right. And I think it is significant that Ukraine are saying that this spotter had taken pictures of this target, because, of course, Russia claims it doesn't deliberately hit civilian targets. Clearly, this was a civilian target, a pizzeria used by people in the area, including teenagers, as we heard, who were killed. And the suggestion is the allegation that there was someone there who was providing specific intelligence for this missile strike through the GRU to the Russian military to allow it to be hit on this occasion. And so President Zelensky, referring to that very specifically in his overnight address, saying this person should be charged with treason, that people who helped the Russians are betrayers of humanity, and that this individual could face up to life imprisonment.
Gordon Carrera. A new report predicts that China will double its capacity to generate renewable energy by 2025, hitting government targets 5 years ahead of schedule. Researchers at the US-based Global Energy Matters described the progress as jaw-dropping. Will Leonardo reports.
China, the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases, wants to generate a third of its electricity from renewables by 2030. This new data shows it already produces more solar power than all other nations combined, while also making huge strides in wind. The researchers hailed policies including generous subsidies, with sparsely populated northern and northwestern areas now hosting sprawling solar and wind farms. But getting this energy to where it's needed is no easy task. The report highlights the need to upgrade the energy grid and invest in power storage. And the government remains a long way off weaning the country off coal, its current electricity mainstay. It's commissioned more coal power stations already this year than in the whole of 2021.
That report from Will Leonardo. Now, still to come in this podcast, the US has reported the first cases of malaria spreading inside the country in 20 years.
Who's your pick for the all-time greatest African goalkeeper? See if your choice made the list on Match of the Day, Africa Top 10.
Let's get into it.
Starting next week.
Sri Lanka's economy is struggling, but a new plan unveiled by the central bank could offer some stability. Last year, the country dived into an economic and political crisis after it failed to make a payment on its foreign debt, and protests broke out over fuel prices. Our South Asia business correspondent Archana Shukla told me Sri Lankans have been given a five-day holiday as the government seeks to avoid volatility in the financial markets when it starts implementing its plans.
This is also to manage any potential bank run. There have been concerns that there could be a negative market reaction as well. So, you know, although the government has said bank depositors will be protected, there have been fears that the recast of the local debt will put further pressure on the banking sector. So while the government discusses and approves this program, this five-day bank holiday will give them a buffer. It will avoid any potential rush to withdraw deposits by concerned depositors.
Oh, I see. Now, who does Sri Lanka owe money to?
It's both local and foreign creditors. As of 2022, Sri Lanka has a total debt of about $84 billion. Half of it almost is to sovereign bondholders, foreign creditors, as well as bilateral lenders like China, India and Japan. The rest of it, about $42 billion, is held by local lenders who invest in securities that are issued locally by the government and pension funds. Now, the government has been negotiating with all its lenders, both local and foreign, to get better repayment plans as designed and approved by the IMF, who has given them a bailout package.
Just give us a sense of what life is like for Sri Lankans.
You know, last year we saw massive images of long queues outside fuel stations, you know, shortages, and that led to protests. That scene has now completely changed. So on the ground, on the surface of it, those long queues have gone. Food, medicine and fuel shortages have been eased. So that's available. Inflation, which was at sky high last year to 70%, that has come down to a large extent, but it is still at 40%. So prices for daily life essentials is still very high, and that is continuing to pressurize the middle class and the lower income groups. Taxes have gone up, petrol, diesel prices have gone up, and that's also affecting many small businesses. Last time when I visited, I saw restaurants and shops have actually closed down because it's very difficult now to do business. So I would say the tipping point of the crisis has now moved.
Archana Shukla. To Japan, where final preparations are underway to release over 1 million tonnes of treated radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. Officials say the wastewater must be removed from the 1,000 tanks it's being stored in to allow the decommissioning of the Fukushima nuclear power plant. In March 2011, the facility was hit by a huge earthquake, which destroyed its cooling systems and caused 3 reactors to melt, making it one of the world's worst ever nuclear disasters. Jim Smith, Professor of Environmental Science here in the UK, has examined the effects of nuclear waste on marine life around the world and spoke to the BBC.
Well, the wastewater had lots of different radioactive elements in it. So things like radioactive cesium, radioactive strontium and so on. So that's passed through, the Japanese call their system the Alps system. So it kind of filters the water and then it goes through a series of columns with materials that absorb these radionuclides. And so that takes all the other radionuclides out of the wastewater and down to really, really very, very low levels and well below the safe limits for discharge. And tritium is much more difficult to remove because tritium is found in the form of tritiated water, we call it. So it's one of the, water is H2O. So one of the hydrogen molecules is replaced by a radioactive hydrogen molecule called tritium. And so that water becomes slightly radioactive because it's just water. It's very, very difficult to separate from the ordinary water. Mm. And so nuclear sites all around the world, the common practice is to discharge that to seas or rivers or lakes, as the Japanese are doing.
We've heard concerns on this programme from Pacific Island environmental activists, from just today another environmental specialist at the University of Hawaii, that simply they're worried about the long-term effects of this treated water floating around the Pacific Ocean. Do you feel it's safe?
Well, I think they're completely wrong, I'm afraid. This is something that happens all over the world. So the amount of tritium that's going into the Pacific from the Fukushima plant is about 22 terabecquerels. Now, just to put that in some sort of context, South Korea and Chinese nuclear power stations are putting about 60 to 80 terabecquerels every year into the Pacific. The La Hague facility in northern France is putting about 10,000 terabecquerels every year of tritium into the English Channel between Britain and France. Sellafield in the UK, we put about 1,000 terabecquerels every year of tritium. And so this release from Fukushima will be much, much so, 450 times lower than what the French have been putting into the English Channel for the last decades, to no significant environmental effect.
So why the concern, do you think? Is it an emotional thing?
I've worked a long time on Chernobyl, and we have the same issues at Chernobyl, that people associate whatever happens with that dramatic event that happened at the time of the accident, and it certainly was dramatic and horrifying. I think if this had been a normal nuclear power station, then nobody would have paid any attention to what's happening. But of course, because it's Fukushima, the world's attention is on it.
Professor Jim Smith there, speaking to the BBC's James Copnell. The Israeli Prime Minister says one of the most contentious elements of his government's planned overhaul of the judicial system will be dropped. Benjamin Netanyahu said the bill would no longer allow Parliament to overturn Supreme Court rulings. Here's Sebastian Usher.
The radical judicial overhaul has been pushed by the religious and ultra-nationalist parties in Israel's current governing coalition. It's created one of the biggest divisions within Israeli society for many years, with hundreds of thousands protesting every week against what they see as an attack on democracy. In the face of those demonstrations, Mr. Netanyahu paused the process back in March, but now it's back on the agenda. In his interview with the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Netanyahu said he was attentive to the public pulse and he'd thrown out the key provision of the plan that would have curbed the Supreme Court's powers. But he intimated that a proposal to give politicians more control over choosing judges would still go ahead in some form.
Sebastian Usher. Now, the majority of malaria cases are found in sub-Saharan Africa, but the disease has made an unwelcome return to the United States. For the first time in 20 years, there have been cases reported in the southern states of Florida and Texas. This follows warnings last week from European scientists that mosquito-borne diseases are on the rise there too. Dr. Estelle Martin from the University of Florida's Department of Entomology and Nematology told us why this is happening.
I think a lot of that is related to globalization. So the fact that we travel more and we travel faster from one part of the world to another. So in that case, it would be from malaria endemic country to the United States. And so in the US, we have like about 2,000 what we call imported cases or travel related cases every year. So that's one possibility. And then I'm sure you heard of what we call the airport malaria. And so in that case, it's a little bit different. It's not infected people that travel back from an endemic area. It is an infected mosquito that can travel back. In my opinion, you know, right now, it's very isolated. We have only 4 cases. And if you look at the data through history, so since malaria was eradicated in the United States, we had those episodic outbreaks. You know, we have a lot of introduction of the parasite in the U.S., but it doesn't, you know, always result in a local outbreak. And when it does, it is usually short-lived.
Dr. Estelle Barton. Now, after the lockdowns, the social distancing, the mask wearing and all the rest, you may not be quite ready for an important bit of news. Viruses are not all bad. Indeed, some viruses called phages may be so good that they can solve one of the greatest problems faced by medicine today, antibacterial resistance. Tom Ireland, author of The Good Virus, The Untold Story of Phages, told us more about this.
A phage is short for bacteriophage, so that's simply a virus that infects bacteria. So a microbe of a microbe. And of course, most people think of viruses as things that make us ill and kill us. But actually, the vast majority of viruses in the world are viruses that have evolved to infect and exploit other microbes, so bacteria. And although this kind of sounds quite obscure and niche, they're actually really important in terms of keeping bacterial populations under control. They modulate bacterial populations in our gut, and we ingest them and drink them every day. But then there's this idea of using them to treat bacterial infections, which is once again being taken very seriously.
Once again, because there are still parts of the world which do use phages medically, don't they?
Yeah, so in Georgia, as in, you know, the former Soviet country, you can literally walk into a pharmacy and buy packets of phages. They've been using phages in medicine there since the 1930s, and unlike the rest of the world, never stopped.
And use them for what, Tom? What sort of thing would you go and get a bottle of phages for?
They have ointments infused with phages for skin conditions. They have, you can swig a vial of phages if you have an upset stomach. And then they have these specialist clinics that actually treat more severe infections. Any kind of bacterial infection, they'll find a phage that can kill that particular bacterial species.
And are they not used particularly in the West simply because, you know, antibiotics did the job perfectly well, in fact, extremely well, and therefore there seemed to be no need for them?
Exactly, yeah. So in the 1920s and 30s, the whole world went mad for phages. It was actually a very common way of treating bacterial infections. But when antibiotics like penicillin came along and were widely available in the 1940s, they were just so much more convenient and easy to use that the idea of using phages was abandoned and pretty much forgotten, actually, in the West. And where the supply of antibiotics was less consistent in the Soviet Union, the idea actually flourished, and they were producing phages on a kind of industrial scale, and they were being sent all across the Soviet Empire throughout the 20th centuries.
Can you see a moment where, because of this worry about antibacterial resistance, that we might actually go back to that as a very common form of medication?
Well, yeah, we are starting to see the idea being explored in small compassionate use cases where people don't have any other options, and very small trials. There's some larger trials happening in the US, but this is a very complicated form of medicine to administer. So there's never going to be a kind of off-the-shelf phage option like we have with antibiotics, where you know they'll work on a very broad spectrum of patients and different types of infections.
Tom Ireland there, speaking with the BBC's Nick Robinson. Now, just before we go, a question. Do you think artificial intelligence, or AI, is going to replace you? We're going to record a special Global News podcast about AI. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. What job do you think could never be replaced by a robot? Please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition of the Global News podcast was mixed by Craig Kingham, and the producer was Andrew Ocheng. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Qureshi, and until next time, goodbye.
In our restless world, the news never stops.
Millions there are affected by hunger, the economy has collapsed.
And sometimes positive stories can get a bit lost. The Happy Pod is a special weekly episode from the Global News Podcast, full of inspiring audio and positive news stories from around the world.
A really good vibe, you know?
I've got some good news for you.
Listen now by searching for the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, wherever you get your podcasts.